the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. Livia Cohn is Professor Emerita of Religion and East Asian Studies at Boston University. Her specialty is Taoism and the study of Chinese longevity practices. A long-term practitioner of Tai Chi Shun and meditation, she is also a certified instructor of yoga and Qigong. One of the world's foremost scholars, Livia is expert at placing each practice in its historical and cultural context, relating its current application and effectiveness to modern Western living. Livia, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, hello, and thank you for having me today.
Well, first, how about a glimpse? I wonder if you would have a personal story or reflection or insight into the Taoism practice that you could share that has been meaningful to you.
Yes, there's some Taoist, the way of the Tao of being in the world is a very cheerful way. We connect to cosmic universal life energy, and we feel that the Tao or life energy or the greater universe is, you know, flowing through us, and that we're here to make the world a better place and to be happy and to make others happy. And so it's a very, one of the things that has attracted me to the religion and that has continued to fascinate is the degree of cheerfulness, humor, and lightheartedness that it entails.
Thank you very much, Livia. Now, we're going to get into health and longevity in this conversation, but first, may I ask, how did you become interested in this field of Asian study?
I got interested in Asian studies in general when I grew up in Germany. In Germany, you have to make a decision on what you want to be life at a fairly early point, and I was interested in languages. Somebody suggested I look into Oriental languages, so I did, and started to study Chinese. Then within Chinese studies, which in Germany encompasses everything, you do history and philosophy and literature and all these things. I then was attracted by their religion, which is quite different from Western. And then I was a exchange student at the University of California at Berkeley. And the professor there, Edward Schaefer, was a major research person in Taoist studies, taught several classes, so I got involved in it. So it was more like an academic interest, knowing that I would be good at languages, being attracted by this particular professor to go into this.
Thank you very much. Now, the Taoist tradition, can you share just what are some of its basic principles?
Yes, like I've already said, the Taoist tradition focuses on Tao, and Tao is the underlying power of the universe. It's the creative force of the universe. It is present everywhere. It is an immanent force that, you know, pervades everything. And it is mostly manifest or most tangible in something we call life energy or vital energy, which the Chinese call qi. And it's like the qi in the word of qigong, qigong
right.
Meaning working with qi.
Yeah.
And so you really understand yourself as an energetic being. And the energies flow in a pattern of yin and yang. So it's either rising or falling or expanding or contracting, but it's never static. So nothing ever stays the same for very long.
Mm.
It keeps on moving in these different rhythms. And then there's different degrees of harmony. Your goal is to be in the flow, to be with the force.
Yes, may the force be with you. Yes, and to go with the flow of energy. Now, for those who know little, let's say, about Taoism, let's share a little bit of what are the three jewels of the Tao?
Well, we do have the three jewels. Well, you have the Tao itself is a major treasure. We call them the three treasures. Is a major treasure, which is like the creative power of the universe. And then the text, so the descriptions, the philosophical and spiritual writings of the tradition that are contained in a compendium known as the Taoist Canon. And there, it has various editions over the years. The one that has survived is from the 15th century, and then there's additions to that. So it's a large compendium of material. So the sacred scriptures. And then it's the practitioners, the people, the community of practitioners, and the living people who activate the Tao through the wisdom of the scriptures in their lives.
Mm. Thank you very much for that clarity. That's very helpful. And now, you mentioned practitioners. How is Taoism practiced? And what would it look like in your day?
Well, there are different dimensions within the tradition, and this is, again, it's very typical. Other religions have something very similar. We distinguish a more intellectual approach, which we call philosophical or literati, where people would really be more into that poetry, and they would philosophize about things, and they would sort of gain inspiration from the tradition. They might not be doing very much, but they might be reading, you know, some literature, like said, the Tao Te Ching, which is like the main ancient text of the tradition.
Right.
And then the second form would be what we call organizational or communal, where you do have, again, as in many other religions, you have a priesthood, you have organized rituals, you have purification ceremonies, you have a community of believers, where people go to temples. It's harder to do in the West. You'd be in a Chinese context. You'd go to a temple, you'd share meals, you do social work, you have rituals, various kinds of community activities. And then the third one is the one that you're interested in, the longevity branch of the tradition, where you do various kinds of physical and meditation type of techniques that bring you in line with Tao as vital energy, as life energy, and you make yourself healthier and you make your life more cheerful and more fortunate.
That sounds fascinating, and we're going to be getting into that in this conversation in a little bit. But now when we're talking about the energy of the universe and we're talking about human beings, then what is the place of human beings from a Taoist perspective? What is this physical life?
The physical life or the spiritual life? From a Taoist perspective, they say that human beings among all the creatures in the world are the most spiritual and the most aware. And so it is, you know, animals have their instincts and they have their function in life, but human beings have an instinct level, but they also have a spiritual and an intellectual level. And so we're the ones that can transform in the most powerful way, both ourselves and the world around us. So human beings are part of the natural process and part of the entire, but they also have a particularly high level of power.
And would a Taoist believe that there is a developing or a goal-oriented approach to spirituality, as though we go through a particular system to evolve to something in particular?
Yes, there is this idea of it's a spiraling. It's not a linear and it's not a circular or cyclical vision. It's a spiral. So the understanding is that you are part of the primordial, the original energy of the universe, but you manifest it in a particular way. And as you keep growing spiritually, that manifestation expands and flourishes and becomes more fully present. So you have a job in this, on this planet, is to become more truly yourself, to, you know, incorporate and manifest the Tao in a more authentic, in a stronger way. And there is there's a spiral both for individuals and also for culture as a whole. The belief is that there is a way for culture to come together in a very powerful, cooperative, integrated way to create the perfect, optimum living conditions for everyone.
Thank you so much. That's a great concept to consider in our philosophical way here, about not only do we spiral and evolve in our lives, but we do as a culture as well, which I think we can all feel or intuit somehow, if not necessarily name very outwardly in the West, that there are so many changes being called upon. Now, and maybe this is a good time to ask you about that, about Taoism in the West. Please share a little more about the spiraling culture and the Western experience of this.
What we're seeing in the West at this time, which is very exciting and very encouraging, is especially from the natural sciences. Developments that make it possible to appreciate the Taoist vision from a modern Western scientific perspective. So much about what the Taoists have been saying about Tao and the way it works and the energies that it has is being confirmed by quantum physics,
right,
chaos theory, and things of that sort. And we do have increasingly modes of medicine, like there's energy medicine now, there's energy psychology now, that adapts and uses modes from Chinese medicine, which are very much informed by the Taoist tradition, to bring together. It's very fascinating how these things come together from a modern Western science perspective and from a Taoist perspective.
Mm. Yes, and I think, you know, we're sort of just beginning to get into that. But of course, there's the book, The Tao of Physics, that came out some time ago.
That
sort of postulated
this when people started to realize this.
Right.
But you're seeing much more detailed and more elaborate understandings and descriptions of this conflagration or confluence of tradition.
Right, right, and that the deeper one gets into particle physics, the more they find themselves in Asian philosophy, and that everything is alive, and it's all one dance that has tendencies to be here and tendencies not. Of course, there's great paradox in that as well, but I'm seeing this myself, and you know, considering these things, like energy medicine for all kinds of things. You know, how do we? You know, the economy is an energy. You know, our relationship with money is an energy.
Absolutely.
And with the media.
There are some very lovely works on this, like Lynn Twist. I don't know if you're familiar with her work. She has a book called The Soul of Money. And there's a lot of it is the wisdom of, you know, instead of running for more and more and more, you learn, which is a key thing already in the ancient Tao Te Ching, you learn to know when it is enough.
Mm.
And you learn to be contented and at peace within yourself. From that peaceful position, you can unfold in ways that you don't even imagine.
Yes, and going beyond that, when we get into greed is when the energy gets really off balance. And we can see that. Now, you've written a lot about Taoist principles and our health. Why don't we discuss that a little bit? For example, and also continuing, our, you know, to apply this to the West, the disciplines that you're, you know, expert in, you know, what are the subtle differences between, you know, meditation or yoga and qigong, and how are we approaching this? That is, in the West, do most people realize yoga is a spiritual practice, or is it more considered like an exercise class?
It depends on what the context is that the people practice their yoga in and the motivation that they come to it. The tendency is that yoga, if it is taught in a gym setting, then the physical is a lot more emphasized. But then again, if you go to a yoga studio, then people really emphasize more of the spiritual parts. And then it also depends on how, whether people are consistent in their practice, if they go regularly or not, because sooner or later, even if you do yoga for a longer time, your perspective will change, energies will open up, and so you start with the physical, but it's also interconnected.
Yeah,
that it does unfold into the spiritual. Mm. And yes, I agree. I've been myself to many yoga classes that have very loud music with it and get to be very vigorous and very, get very exhausted. And it's not like the kind of invert focus that you gently stretch yourself that you're doing. But, you know, there's different forms for everything. The biggest difference between the Indian and the Chinese model is what we've already touched upon, is that in the Chinese world, everything changes and everything shifts, and you're in a constant flow and in constant movement. Whereas in Indian traditional worldview, you do have the concept of a solid something at the core of both the universe and the self. And the self, it's called Atman, or the immortal soul that does not change and that is like your solid inner core. And because in the yogic tradition your goal is to reach to that solid core, you're trying to still and calm down all those external waves, because there's a solid, quiet thing, you know, in the center of the ocean, and there's all these waves around you and in your emotions and in your body and in everything. So yoga has a tendency to be very, to emphasize holding the posture, to be stable. You have balancing postures, where you know, like the tree pose, where you stand on one leg and you're really standing and you become very stable. The Qigong and Tai Chi traditions, the Chinese traditions, there's balancing, but you don't hold anything for it. You're really aware of how energies flow and how energies fall.
Yeah.
You're aware of bringing energies into the body and how different hand movements or physical movements or stretches impact your internal energy.
So
there's more flow in the Qigong than there is in the Qigong.
Yes, and the flow, I've studied Tai Chi, and if anyone doesn't think that's a martial art, I tell you, it is. You get really strong legs doing Tai Chi, but the balance, the symmetry, the side to side, and the flow of energy, it's profound. Now,
but you don't hold in Tai Chi either, especially because it's a martial art. If you were just standing there, someone would mow you down real fast.
Right.
You're always in some form, even if it's very slow, there's always motion.
Yes. Now, in meditation, is there a difference in the Taoist experience of meditation as compared, say, to the Buddhist meditation?
There are a couple of important differences. The most important difference is the importance of the body in the Taoist tradition. And again, it goes down to this same thing, is that the Indian worldview, your immortal soul is this core center thing that is ultimately different from your body. And so in India, for example, everybody gets cremated, because once you die, your soul gets liberated and your body is just a piece of matter and it just gets, it's useless.
Right.
Whereas in China, there's no such distinction. Not a dualistic system. It's a unitary. It's a holistic system. So body and mind and soul are one and the same thing. They're all energy. They're just, it's the same chi. It's the same energy that flows, but your body energy is like a little more slow. The vibrations are a little more slow. The waves are more pronounced. Your mental energy is subtler and faster, and your spiritual energy is very subtle and very fast. But it's still the same energy. So if you're doing a meditation, you're not trying to eliminate the body, or you do not put the body into uncomfortable positions.
Right.
You do not coerce the body. You do not push the body around. There's no, none of that. There is a little bit in some branches of Taoism, but by and large, there's none of that very radical asceticism that we know from India. You know, the starvation and the piercing and the lying on a bed of nails, all those. Because you're really nurturing your body. And all Taoist meditation begins with the body. So you're opening your body, you're really making sure it's healthy, you let the energy flow smoothly, and then your meditation is a guiding of qi through the body. You're letting the qi, visualizing the qi sometimes in different colors, sometimes in different forms, sometimes as just waves, moves through the body. So your body is your foundation. You're refining your mind by paying attention, being really closely connected to the physical body, which is where the whole health thing comes.
Yes, and I was going to ask you then, from where we are right now, then how does this apply to our health? If you could continue this line of thought.
Yeah, it's very good for you, because if you a lot of people in the West, if you have some kind of an ache or pain or a discomfort, your immediate attitude or reaction is to suppress it, take painkiller.
Mm.
We take suppressants of this, that, and the other thing. And whereas in the Taoist tradition, you would not do that.
So what would you do instead?
Yeah, you would work with that. You would see, oh, this particular pain or discomfort is an energetic imbalance. It's trying to tell me something. It's trying to make me alert that, you know, something should be changed. And then you would very gently... you go inside and talk to it, which sometimes you do, or you would just feel and say, well, you know, if I'm not feeling good, maybe I should get more rest, or maybe I should change my diet here. And you just, so you become, as time goes along, you become energetically extremely aware of what's happening inside your body, and that's, again, the ideal of Chinese medicine. Chinese medicine says the best physicians are those that you never really need, because they will tell you, you know, months ahead of time that you should change your lifestyle in order to prevent the disease.
Right, prevention. Yes. Yes, yes. And that's so important, even in our culture today. Now, I would like to get into the longevity and all those practices in the next part of the program.
Yeah.
But before the break, I wanted to ask you, because I've come across such great phrases and names now in Taoism, who are the three pure ones?
The three pure ones are deities. They're representatives of the pure heaven. There's The Taoist religion distinguishes the pure Tao at the core of creation from the Tao as it is manifest in the created world. And then there's a level between there, which we call heaven. It's a pure realm where the Tao has started to manifest in some kind of more material form, but it's not quite concrete yet.
Hmm.
So it's like a pre-creation, the intermediate between the root of creation and the actual created world. And the three pure ones are representative of that sphere. And they represent the original, the energy universal qi divided into three different forms that are represented by the three pure ones. There's various heavens, heavenly spheres, the highest clarity, great clarity, and jade clarity that were developed on this pure level. There's deities, and then there's also certain sacred scriptures that come with this. So this is, the three pure ones are symbolic for the pure energy of Tao that is not of this world, but yet accessible.
Well, that's fascinating that there's a, I can't help but notice that there's a threeness.
Yes.
Or a triune nature in this description that, of course, reminds me, you know, of Trinity.
That's right.
But speaking in energetically, which is actually, helpful.
That's right. And the three pure ones also within themselves have a relationship that is very similar to Trinity, both in Christianity and in Buddhism, where the heavenly venerable of primordial commencement is like the God figure who is the creative force. And then there's the God of the Tao, who is the revelation force, who is like the person, like the Holy Spirit that sort of connects it to humanity. And then the Lord Lao, the highest Lord, highest venerable Lord, is the figure who descends into the human world every so often to give revelations and to assist people, and who becomes flesh once in a while. So we have a very similar pattern there.
Well, thank you so much. That is fascinating. And we're about halfway through the program at this point, so we're going to just take a quick break. Livia, stay on.
Good.
You are listening.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from the break, we will continue our conversation on Taoism, health, and longevity with author and professor Dr. Livia Cohn. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with Michael Franti. Stay with us.
Sometimes to face the things that may block the sun from shining rays and fill my life with shades of gray. And still I long to find a way. So today I pray for grace. I take a moment to myself so I can hear myself. Fear myself and beware myself. Life's addictions and afflictions cause abrasion from the friction. Sometimes it's easier to live in fiction. I can run, but I can't hide from the pains that reside down deep inside. There is no pill that can be swallowed. There is no guru that can be followed. There's no escaping from my own history. Those that I hurt and those that hurt me. I was dead for a million years before I was born, and I'll be dead for a million more after I'm gone. So I live to give something. Like the way you hum a song when the music's gone. Like the warmth of the sand when the sun goes down. And I'm sitting with myself, nobody else is around. But why must I feel like this today? I'm a soldier, but afraid sometimes to face the things that may block the sun from shining rays and fill my life with shades of gray. And still I long to find a way. And so today I pray.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're talking about Taoism, health, and longevity with author and professor Dr. Livia Cohn. And that, of course, was Michael Franti with his song, Pray for Grace. Livia, in this part of the program, I'd like to enter into the subject of longevity now.
Yes.
Could you please share about the history and tradition of Chinese longevity?
Yes, I can do that. Chinese longevity goes back, and the documentation we have for Chinese longevity goes back to about 400 BC. Various methods of long life are mentioned in the ancient Taoist philosophical texts, notably a Zhuangzi. There's an inscription, it's a very brief jade inscription on a block of jade that talks about moving energy through the body, guiding the qi and allowing it to sprout and to create health. There's a more technical text called Guanzi, which talks about meditation methods, sitting upright, rectifying the body, letting the qi move and becoming one was Tao and very healthy. And then we have, very interesting, from about the 2nd century BC, several tomb finds, manuscripts that were found in tombs that actually outline in more detail medical practices and also longevity practices, physical exercises. Some are illustrated, very detailed descriptions and illustrations of these materials. And so what we have from these documents, what we can see is that there is a spiritual dimension to longevity And there's also a physical medical dimension to longevity. And so the longevity practices and the whole tradition is for the prevention of diseases, for the insurance of good health and long life, and also for the spiritual development on the basis of long life. So it's both a physical, medical, and a philosophical, spiritual tradition.
And when we're talking about long life, when we're talking about 400 BC or 200 mm-hmm. BC, what kind of amount of years are we talking about?
Some of these people are talking about 60 to 80 years.
Which back then was pretty miraculous.
Which was very unusual, yes.
Yeah.
Well, most people would die quite early, and you know, in their 40s, 50s.
Huh.
And so, but we do have quite a few of these people that we do know about were living into quite old age.
Mm. And they were detailing the practices.
Yes.
In the manuscripts. Can you share a little bit about how the Taoist practices affected longevity?
Well, when we're talking about, at this stage, what we have is the more philosophical and theoretical tradition of Taoism and the more medical practical tradition of the longevity practice. Taoists was the more religious forms and community and organized forms of Taoism don't develop for another several years. They start about 200. So at this stage, we have Taoism influences the longevity tradition by its concepts, the conception of Tao, the concept of Qi, the idea of the natural flow of things, the way of wholeness, the connecting to the universe. And that is manifest in the medical or in the longevity tradition as a sense of moderation, a sense of knowing when it is enough, a sense of going along with the changes of the seasons. There's a lot of emphasis on doing things in accordance with the weather and the sunlight. So a lot of the practices have to do was recognizing and sort of eating organically and locally, and recognizing where you are in the greater scheme of things.
Mm. It had to do with living in harmony, basically, with the reality around you, with your surroundings.
Yes, yes. That's your number one fundamental premise. All the texts begin with that.
Mm.
You recognize, you know, what your condition is, what your situation is. You look at the nature, at the weather, the climate, the situation around you, and you adjust with that. And the medical people, and they still do this today in China. It's, for example, when it is very hot in the summer, they recommend that you don't cool yourself off too radically, because if you put too much cold in your body when it's hot outside, then another few months later you will suffer serious colds. Mm. Cold outside. So in other words, you want to balance the outside cold, but you don't want to go to extreme. The outside hot or cold.
Right.
You don't want to go to extreme.
Right. I've heard the advice that on a really hot day, if one has something like a cup of hot tea,
yes,
it will actually cool you down more. Does that resonate?
That's very different. I mean, most Chinese medical practitioners will recommend that you stay away from ice cream.
Yeah.
In this culture.
It's a big cultural shift for a lot of us here.
Yeah. It's very difficult to get cold drinks.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting because so long ago they had, you know, discerned about living in harmony with seasons and surroundings, and we seem to be coming back to that now with a new awareness, with the local foods and seasonal, foods. We're catching up again.
I would think so.
Yeah. Now, let's share about some of your books. You have written quite a bit and edited quite a few works. What do your books focus on?
My academic career started with the question of immortality. The way the Taoist goal in life is translated into English is with the word immortality.
Okay.
And when I was a student, it was not well understood at all. And some people were saying, oh, these Taoists, they're so silly. They believe that you can actually be immortal and your body will not decay. And God, look, how stupid they are. But at the same time, my teachers for traditional Chinese culture and language were telling me how ancient China had like the single most sophisticated culture on the planet and was like amazingly ahead, and how they had all this insight. And it's like something's wrong here. I mean, either these people are stupid and they don't know that we die, or they're like really sophisticated and they know something we don't know. And so I started to figure out what was going on with that. So my entire writing is in some form or another about this phenomenon of the goal of Taoist practice, this ideal of immortality. And my first step in the 1980s was to connect it to mysticism. That, okay, these people don't, they die eventually, but in their minds and in their spirits, they overcome death. So even though physically they may die, spiritually they don't. So they're really like mystics in other cultures.
Right.
So I have a book on Taoist mystical philosophy and a book called Early Chinese Mysticism that does like comparative mysticism studies and unearths, digs up all this material.
Go ahead.
And then I got interested more in the mythological thing, and I have a study of Lord Lao, who's like the central deity of the tradition. Then I got interested in the concrete practices and the whole ethical, because people were saying, oh, these Taoists, they don't really have any ethics. It's like you just flow along with the Tao and you don't have any morals. Okay, well, let's look at that. There's 180 or more texts in the Taoist canon that specify rules and give you ethical guidelines.
Yeah.
So I wrote about monastic life, I wrote about ethics, and then recently I've been more involved with the body question, health and life, Taoist body cultivation, and the longevity techniques. I have a book called Chinese Healing Exercises, which is history of the Qigong yoga type exercises from the early manuscripts to the 20th century.
And that's fascinating. Now, why would folks think that the Taoists would not have an ethical, tradition?
Because in the ancient texts, there are really no guidelines and no rules, and a lot of the ideal is to just, you've heard of non-action.
Yes.
Wu Wei. It's just like, okay, just do nothing, just go with the flow, just hang out.
Didn't identify what good flows and bad flows.
So the image is of the Taoist who just couldn't care less about society.
Right.
Of course, everybody.
Well, I see that. Well, very good, Olivia. And is there anything more that you would like to add for regarding our culture today and the help that Taoist principles might offer?
Yes, the culture today I think the most important thing that Taoists can offer the culture is the understanding of personality and personal being as part of a greater whole. So of people starting to, on a very physical and very basic energetic basis, feeling themselves more connected with everything that's going on around them. They're not an isolated entity, but everything impacts on everything else. And we were talking the other day with somebody, and we talked about how this person was feeling very happy most of the time and was very cheerful and had good health and things. Then he was saying, I feel very happy, but then I also feel guilty because there's so many people out there who are not happy. And why should I just have all this happiness? And my answer to him was, every time and every moment you're happy, you're making the whole universe a better place.
Mm.
So everything we do, and that is good for us, and that is makes us harmonious and cheerful, creates waves that radiate throughout the galaxy.
Well, that is just a beautiful thought, and so helpful, and practical as well. The tangible experience of spirituality is always, I find it really energetic and uplifting, and I wanted to thank you for that. Livia, as we come toward the end of the interview, where can people find out more information about you, your books, or Taoism in general?
There's three websites that would be very good. I have my own personal website that has some biography and some posts on activities that I do. It's very simple, liviacohn.com. And then there is the publishing company that I'm involved in that specializes in books on Taoism. I publish my own books, but we also have a very nice book on the Eight Immortals in there, and a new book called Qigong meets Quantum Physics by a physicist who's also a Qigong teacher. That publishing company is called Three Pines Press, which is like the number three, and then pine like the pine tree, threepinespress.com. And the other website that is very helpful for resources on Taoist activities, Taoist books, and book reviews and things, and Taoist classes at university, is a website called Taoiststudies.org, which is Taoist with a D, and studies in one word, and .org.
Thank you so much, Livia. And we're going to be posting all this contact information on our website shortly at our homepage at GodspeedInstitute.com for listeners to follow up. I wanted to thank you so much for being on the program today and for sharing from your expertise on Taoism and your own personal journey.
Yes, well, thank you.
It's been a pleasure, and best of luck.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay. Now, listeners, before we wrap up the show, I've got a tip for your spiritual tool belt that you wrap around yourself each week. And this one focuses on the topic of mysticism or the mystical call. Perhaps people are interested in the mystical call or what that means in their life, how it applies to their religious practices or spiritual experience. And I want to share this reflection with you, which focuses on a rainy, muddy trek that I undertook some years ago over a summer in North Wales, and I just would like to share this with you. The summer rain beat down hard upon me, high upon the hillside. After a summer spent traveling in England, Cornwall, and South Wales, the mountains of North Wales now emblazoned their blue-green color in my mind's eye. Not quite emerald green, the Welsh landscape is slightly more blue, like the emerald's rich cousin Dioptase, and filled with teal-blue fields and forests. Drenched to the skin, I looked up the hill. I was about halfway to the top. The thunder bellowing in the churning charcoal sky made me consider turning back several times, back to the warmth and safety of nearby lodging, hearth, and pub, but I had come so far. It had to be today, this day. I had to keep going. I continued trudging in the deluge. The higher I climbed up this mountain in Snowdonia, the more immense and overpowering the view grew, until I felt I was meeting the clouds, high above the fortress below, high above the old seaside town nestled around the harbor, up to the dead-drop cliff overlooking the sea, white waves crashing against dark rocks. I was following a mystical calling, one that had begun in childhood, intensified through high school and college, and culminated in this adventure into my Celtic heritage. At 20 years old, I mapped out the footsteps of King Arthur, Tintagel, Kalyan, Carnarvon, and followed in his path to find my own, hoping to solve the mystery of images that both inspired and haunted me for years, images that began and ended in one simple thing, a white rose. My journey led me here, to this place of origin, this ancient Britain site on a remote hilltop where the Celtic and Roman worlds overlapped in layers of early Christianity. And the very real white rose that had somehow called to me to find it, beckoning across time and space from a crumbling hilltop settlement to my modern Manhattan dorm room, was only a moment away, waiting in full bloom on the mountaintop, bobbing heavily, laden with the raindrops of this summer storm. It would become the meditation piece of a lifetime. A greater mystery had invited me to come and recollect this rose, a simple expression of nature's beauty somewhere in the world, and I had found it. The Grail, too, is a simple object. The gifts of mystical quests usually are. For some, the invitation to explore the mystical in life is subtle and playful, evolving over time. For others, the invitation to the mystical journey arrives with our name on it, engraved, and it can shake up our world, demanding its place before all practical plans and convenience. In the end, what is more important than the prize itself is the journey of seeking it, the path that moves our gaze away from the horizon and toward the very earth on which we walk, the air we breathe, and the consciousness of our very life. The mystical journey can tap into and transform our deepest self, thereby transforming our surroundings, too, into heralds and manifestations of timeless symbols of love. When engaging the mystical path, we connect differently with God and our own story, and the soul may unfold to full bloom. Thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.